Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the real challenges facing Arizonans. Welcome to Democratic Perspective. This week, Mike Costantino and I will be discussing international affairs. You know, we focus on Medicare. We focus on really domestic issues and stuff. But once a month, Mike and I were talking, and we'd like to focus on international affairs. Today, we have are going to discuss Arab Spring. Arab Spring is the vast amount of changes happening now in the Arab world. And we have with us today Fatin Goshen. And Mike, tell us a little bit about her.
Yeah, Fatin is a native of Lebanon. She's an assistant professor in international relations and School of Government and Public Policy and at the Center for Mideastern Studies right here at the University of Arizona. Dr. Goshen received her BA and MA from the American University in Beirut, and she got her PhD at Pennsylvania State. A lot of her research focuses on the interaction of adversaries. That's fascinating. Her work has appeared in I didn't even know this journal exists. It's kind of comforting that this journal actually exists. The Conflict Management and Peace Science, and other publications, International Negotiation, International Studies Quarterly, as well as Middle East Journal.
I generally don't like the metaphors in politics, but Arab Spring seems a really good name for what's happening. A kind of political ice is broken, and all kinds of new things are emerging. What is not really clear? I was looking at when a lot of the older Arab leaders had assumed power, Gaddafi in 1971, Mubarak in 1981. In Yemen, the president there assumed power of North Yemen in 1978. Syria, Jordan, the Gulf states are sort of authoritarian family dynasties, whatever the theoretical form of government. So we want to ask, what's happening and why is it happening now?
Right. Yeah. And then that's where we're going to you, Goshen. Let's try to get past the headlines.
All right.
The TV
good morning.
News. And we're going to ask you the difficult question. Looking forward, what next? What do you think the Arab world will look like in the future?
That's a probably $1 million question.
Yeah.
I wish I had the complete answer for, or at least the complete time for. But one thing is, I think that's being missed in the media, is that this is not the first time that we've had protests for change. We'll just take the example of Egypt. They had protests in 2007, 2008, then in 2010. Now, what is new and interesting, though, about this time is that there has been some success. And part of the reason, I think, for this success is both the role of the international media and in general, and Al Jazeera in particular. I think, the previous times we did not see the protests being broadcasted as much as before. And the second, I think, what is interesting, probably also for your viewers, is the United States' approach to this. In the previous years when there were protests, the United States, in particular in the case of Egypt, has always come down on the side of the government and Mubarak, who's been a huge and great ally for American interests in the region. So for the first time, in contrast to previous U.S. administrations, we see that this administration decided to keep a hands-off and allow the protests to move forward.
So through all the previous Republican administrations and Democratic administrations, this is the first time that there's been some, if not encouragement, certainly allowance.
Absolutely. Definitely during President George Bush's, two terms, but also during President Clinton. I mean, when there were some attempts at, when President Clinton was going around and talking about his U.S. engagement enlargement speech in 1993 about bringing democracy to the world, I mean, some of his staff were quoted as saying, except for the Middle East, because we would value stability in the Middle East over the democratization. Because I think people here, even in the United States, I think it's hard to remember what it takes to become a democracy, right? It's not overnight. I mean, even in the United States, if we go back to the history, it was a struggle, and there was uncertainties, and there was ups and downs. And but because we've been a democracy for so long, we sometimes forget that it doesn't stabilize overnight. And actually, democracies that are, or countries that are transitioning to democracies are in their weakest, they're usually the most volatile and the most aggressive in general because of different domestic factors that could, and international factors. So people are worried about the process to becoming a democracy. And
so you're giving a high marks to the Obama administration for their response or lack of response.
Well, it's been interesting, right, because it's been mixed, depending, and that's, I think, what is missing in the media. And that's why I think my answer to your question, it depends, because it depends which country we're talking about. Because the factors of change or the factors that are on the ground are different. If we want to talk about Tunis, I think Tunis has the most, probably the most chance of becoming a democracy and or stabilizing and moving forward. Because in Tunis, two things happen differently. First of all, it's not in the what we call in the Levant area, not within the Arab-Israeli conflict. It's outside, one. And two, it was the people and the military sided together against the government. And so that helped get rid of the previous regime and ousted it from the area. And now they are building themselves with organizations, non-governmental organizations, international organizations, putting together commissions to move forward and see what is best for Tunis. Egypt, similar in the sense it was the people, absolutely. The people were the ones on the streets demanding for change. Difference is the military stood on the sidelines. And what we're no longer hearing about Egypt in the news, and people are not looking closely. What ended up happening was Mubarak left, but he appointed General Sleiman, who was the director of intelligence, and he's now in charge. And there's no real discussion moving forward about the changes that are supposed to be happening. And actually, in one incident that was brought up recently in the case of Egypt, is that this new government is trying to change or proposing to drop the quota, for example, of women in the upcoming election. Now, what is interesting about that is that in 1983, a law was put in place in Egypt in order to provide a certain quota for women in parliament. And all of a sudden, this new regime is requesting for dropping that quota. Well, it would mean that the women were not going to have a good chance of being put on the ballots or getting elected. So we're no longer hearing about that.
Part of what I see in Egypt is a response to popular opinion, which is a first. There's been, as you said, protests before, but never a government response in favor. And I'm looking at the opening of the gate between Gaza and Egypt, which I believe was opened in response to public pressure. Is that true?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, it was definitely in response. But what is interesting about this new regime that's in place, the transition regime, the military transition regime, is that it's trying to appease the public on certain things and still maintaining its stronghold on other things, right? So I think
so the military still controls Egypt behind the scenes. And once everybody stopped looking, then we've gotten into a period where the ice is not breaking again. In other words, you're not seeing the kind of change that all those very brave demonstrations were about.
Absolutely. And this is the sad thing, is that we're not seeing it move forward in the same manner as in Tunis. And it is problematic. I mean, even in this regime, it's going to have to think about how long it can do this. Because what was interesting in 2009, the United Nations Development Program published a report on the state of the Arab world. And what was notable in that report was that 2 out of 5 people in the Arab world live on $2 or less a day. And more importantly, there's a young workforce that's emerging. If you look at all the nations in the Arab world, the majority of them are young. They're educated. So you have this huge young, educated group of youth that are very well connected to the internet, you know, through the globalization, through internet and other factors, are seeing what's happening around the world, now have more demands from their governments. And unless the governments are able to create 50 million new jobs by 2020, then they will not be able to accommodate this growing youthful workforce,
wow,
which again means we're going to have problems.
Right. Once again, since I'm asking you the hard question, and this one is no more just as delicate here in Sedona, Arizona, as it would be in New York City, New York, and that is, how does this emerging populism in the Arab world going to affect, or will it affect, the Arab-Israeli? Your specialty is conflict and resolution. There's been no longer-standing conflict in modern times than the Arab-Israeli conflict. How is all of this going to affect Arab-Israeli relations?
Well, you know, what is interesting is, again, it depends on the leadership in the U.S., in Israel. Just yesterday, I was reading in the Israeli newspapers that one of the former intelligence high up in Israel was criticizing Netanyahu and was criticizing him for his approach to the Arab world. And this person is very well known to have carried out one of the most missions against the Arab world, you know, and so he's a very hawk. And yet here he is saying, I'm criticizing the approach of Israel to the Arab world because we need to take this opportunity rather than go on the offensive and talking about threat and security and attacking Iran, attacking Syria, attacking. He said, we need to deal with the issues of the Palestinians. And, you know, and we have to, and he actually suggested even the 1967 borders, which President Obama just recently talked about. So this was interesting coming from a person that is very well known in Israel to be an extreme hawk. And the newspaper was saying that if this person is saying that, you know, Prime Minister Netanyahu's foreign policy in the Middle East is not the right one, he said we should not be sleeping well at night. And so I think the problem right now in Israel is that the community is divided.
Right.
You have the people on the center and center left who believe in a two-state solution. They believe that the end to the Israeli-Palestinian problem is a two-state solution. Many of them are willing to negotiate on the 1967 borders. But the problem, for example, on the right, in Israel, and for example, Prime Minister Netanyahu's party and himself, they do not believe in a two-state solution.
Right.
Prime Minister Netanyahu, a couple years ago, clearly stated that he believed the best option for the Palestinians is more of a creation of cantons and dividing them into sovereign areas, but not a Palestinian state.
We have just a couple of minutes left, Professor, but How will the populism affect? Will it put pressure on the Arab-Israelis conflict to finally come to some peaceful resolution, or will we just have? We'll go to our graves and the conflict will still be going on.
Is there a post-Netanyahu solution?
I think there is. I think we reach very, very close to a solution, and I think there is the Arab Initiative, which is that was put together 2002 and then 2007. It is going to require the United States to be a little bit more aggressive in terms of sticking and not, I mean, President Obama has laid out some really good ideas, but unfortunately he gets attacked from within the United States, from the right, and from the right within Israel, and not enough support is coming out even from here for President Obama's vision. And unless there is, then there's not going to be a movement. I mean, without the United States putting some involvement to move it forward, it's just going to be a stalemate.
Can we have you come back on our program in a couple of 3 weeks?
Yeah, we're going to have to end it
next month because we're going to have to end here. But we really do want to discuss this in some depth. I think it's one of the most important things around. Thank you for coming on Democratic Perspective.
Thank you.
Next week we'll be talking about Medicare and health care. We'll be returning to international affairs about once a month. We hope you guys will all listen in.
We're going to VVID. Don't forget you can hear all this on Verde Valley Independent Democrats website.
You've been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 o'clock news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.